House Committee on Revenue will come to order for Monday, May 16th, 2011. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3655. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
More than I expected.
Members of the committee. House Bill 3655 deletes the requirement that state agencies offer certain liquidated and delinquent accounts for assignment to private collection agency and changes the language to permissive. You also have in your packet a dash one amendment that modifies a 6-month time period to a 1-year time period. And that language where it's changed from the dash one is on page 2, lines 9 through 14. Just changes uniformly a 6-month period to a 1-year period.
Very good. Thank you. Let's hear from Ken Ross, Amelia Porterfield.
Good morning, Chair Bernhardt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amelia Porterfield. I'm with SEIU Local 503, and we represent over 20,000 state workers, including those at the Department of Revenue. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. The Department of Revenue collects various types of debts, those tax debts that the department has itself, but also collects debts for other agencies who are unable to do it themselves because they don't have the infrastructure or expertise in their own agencies. Under current statute, the Department of Revenue is required to send after a certain time period, depending on the type of debt, they're required to send those debts to private collection firms. They're not the easiest monies to collect out there. They're not the ones that just walk right in the door. Typically, Department of Revenue staff are able to collect 20 to 22% of these debts. Private collection firms tend to bring in just under 2% of the liabilities that are assigned to them. And historically, there's been discussion about whether that disparity in numbers is because the private firms are collecting older debts versus the newer debts in-house. But this issue came up in the recent Secretary of State's audit of the Department of Revenue, and one of the recommendations within that audit was that the agency refine the criteria of submission of cases to private collection firms. And as a result of that, the department undertook 2 different pilot project studies, basically to measure the effectiveness of the private firms versus in-house collections, and using the same types and ages of debt, so it's actually an apples-to-apples comparison. A little interesting information out of those studies. The first pilot project involved sending debts of varied size and age to 2 different firms, with one of the firms working on a flat fee structure. The pilot raised some concerns, including the fact that one of the contracted private collection firms failed to remit payments in a timely manner to the department and continually pass that work back to the department staff. Also, statistics from the pilot showed that one Department of Revenue staff member working less than half time was able to collect more than one of the firms. Than each of the firms in that pilot. The second pilot project was a little bit different. The department assigned over 1,000 new tax debts to 3 different private collection firms and in-house staff. It was a double-blind comparison, and the in-house staff just had those debts mixed into their queues without knowing which ones they were or that they were being tracked. The private firms had those had their cases mixed into their work and weren't told they were being tracked either. And some interesting information came out of that. So the in-house staff collected about 20% of the debts given to them in that study. And the private firms, which fared quite a bit better than their typical numbers of around 2%, brought in 10%, 8%, and 10%, respectively. But the department also found that there's quite a bit of staff work involved in maintaining those accounts with the private firms. And additionally, the state pays a 16 to 23% commission to those firms to do that work. So when you add that all up, we find that it's not the most effective way to collect tax debt. And the department themselves and their testimony to the Ways and Means General Government Subcommittee said that since the process of managing accounts assigned to private firms is so labor-intensive and collections are lower than internal efforts, we can better use our staff by keeping the accounts in-house. However, a statutory change would be necessary. And so here's that statutory change. House Bill 3655 would just change the language from shall to may, allowing the department to have the discretion for when it is more efficient and effective to collect debts in-house and can bring in more money that way. They're allowed to do so and not required to send it out of house based on an arbitrary timeline. But if it doesn't make sense to send debts out of house, they're still able to do so. I don't know that we know exactly why in-house or out-of-house collects more or less. I do know that the staff in the Department of Revenue are very committed to working with taxpayers. They're their customers every single year. They have interest in education and helping those folks be in compliance, not only on the debt that they're collecting right now, but for the long haul. And so I think having that relationship helps in a long-term capacity. We have a $1.25 billion tax gap in this state, and in 2009 alone, the state sent $146 million in debt liabilities to private collection firms. So I think there's actually a significant impact that could be made by increasing that level of collection. So with that, we'd encourage your support of this bill. I'm glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you.
Oh, and I should mention, in my handouts, I have submitted both the kind of an excerpt of the department's testimony to the Ways and Means Subcommittee on these studies, as well as this one of the studies themselves.
Thank you very much. Yeah?
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Ken Ross from the Department of Revenue. And, of course, the department is taking a neutral position on this. We're not taking a position on this bill. I would like to speak a little bit to the amendments, though, because we did ask for those.
Please.
The amendment is changes the six-month language for accounts that are sent to our other agency accounts group. So this is the debt that we collect for other agencies. And right now it has a six-month mandatory sending of the debt to private collection firms, but by rule we can get an exemption for that, and we have to apply for that every 2 years. So it's something that we go through DAS to get an exemption to that 6 month language. And so this amendment would codify what we do currently in practice, and we're asking for it because it would make consistently with the rest of the one-year language, and also it kind of makes sense because if we get debt in April, May, or June, and we have to revert it after 6 months, then it doesn't get to go through the tax refund season and isn't available for offset. So it just makes sense that we have a little more control on how long we keep that debt.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
So just in terms of process, the amendments are the Department of Revenue's amendments.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, that's correct.
And Amelia, you have no objection to them.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, in our view, if it's helping to streamline and make more efficient the department's operations, we're fine with that. And we don't see any problems with these amendments.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have one. The process that you were describing that you can use with the rulemaking for other departments' debts on the 6 month time limit, does that also apply to the 1 year time limit on the other debts that the bill is about or not? Your ability to write a rule accepted by DAS that then exempts a category of debt from the process.
Chair Barnhart, that is correct. It's DAS's rule that provides exemptions, and that is for any debt that we're collecting for another agency. By statute, debt that arises within the Department of Revenue is exempt. So mostly we're talking about debt that we collect for other agencies.
So what does this bill actually do?
This bill actually, it makes it permissive so that we don't have to send debt after 1 year to private collection firms.
Okay. But can you get DAS to exempt you from the one-year requirement now by rule? That was what I was trying to get at in my earlier
and question. I believe I misunderstood what you were asking. No, we don't have an exemption for the one-year rule.
Okay. Thank you. So this bill would remove you, with the amendment, would remove the requirement that you had to send out other agencies' debt after 6 months unless you had an exemption by rule from DAS, and it would allow you not to send out after a year the debt, tax debt owed to the department.
Chair,
unless you wanted to.
Correct.
Thank you. Yes,
Representative Wong. Question for DOR. How do you select service providers that are used for private collection activities?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Wong, we go through a contract process, so we basically put it out for bid.
It's an RFQ?
RFP, yes.
Sorry, follow up?
Please, yes.
And how many different service providers do you have on contract at any one time?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Wong, I'm guessing here, but I think we have five or six. We have a handful of them.
Last question.
Yes, please.
For the lady from SEIU. So in the pilot study, did you factor into your analysis the potential for any increased employee cost for not sending these accounts out?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Wand, I should clarify that pilot projects were done by the Department of Revenue, so I was just reading through their analysis. But I don't believe that that work was done. I think this bill being permissive, it would be hard to tell what that impact would be. There's going to be overhead in-house. There's overhead out-of-house. I think the thing that strikes me is that with the private collection firms, you have both. You have the staff time in-house to do the work managing the accounts and transferring information back and forth, plus we have the commission that we pay for the out-of-house overhead. So,
Thank you.
I don't think we have all of that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Jim Marquis, Cindy Robert. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, here to oppose House Bill 3655 and also the amendment from the Department of Revenue. I want to start by giving you just a little background I think is important for you to hear. When Matt Marquis came to work for our firm in 1997, his very first project was to conduct an inventory of liquidated and delinquent receivables owed to the state of Oregon. In that attempt, he partnered with the Senate Budget Committee, chaired by can't remember who the chair was. Senator Neil Bryant. And they put together a questionnaire for state agencies that went out to all state agencies asking for 5 years' worth of information, basic information about their receivables. What did you start the year with in receivables? What did you add? How much did you collect? What was your ending balance of receivables, a brief description of the type of receivables, and an aging of the accounts. There wasn't one state agency in 1997 that could provide that information, not only for 5 years, but even for 3 years. There, eventually, after a lot of phone calls and other efforts, we got the information for all state agencies for 1 year. It was very clear from those reports that at that time, state agencies weren't paying any attention to delinquent receivables. And we've come some distance since then through legislation that requires now state agencies to be a little more accountable and to file an annual report with the Legislative Fiscal Office. About those receivables. We couldn't put aging in that report. The state agencies still say that they're unable to properly age accounts. That ought to scare all of you. My comment to them was, buy QuickBooks. Our receivables are growing at well in excess now of $100 million a year, our liquidated delinquent receivables in this state. We all sit around and talk about who the best person to collect a debt that's 10 years old, and what we ought to be doing is reaching out there and trying to shut the faucet off and doing more work at the front end. We do not have an effective accounts receivable management system in this state still today. Now, Department of Revenue is probably better than most agencies, but remember, this bill would affect all state agencies, and you've got some agencies out there that really don't still pay much attention to this stuff. What I've given you, excuse me just a minute.
If you're looking,
I didn't know if those got handed out.
If you're looking at testimony,
yeah, okay,
we
got
have
handed out. Good. Yeah. So this bill deletes, repeals ORS 293-233, which is the statute that allows for an exemption from mandatory referral to collection agencies. And the exemption process is done by rule within the Department of Administrative Services. And they have done that in the Oregon Accounting Manual, which is on starts on the third page, is all of the ways in which accounts can be exempted from the requirement to send out to a private collection agency. This requires then that agencies, if they don't want to send out an agent an account after 90 days, or in the Department of Revenue's case, 6 months, that they apply for, through an application process, a simple exemption for those accounts. I don't think you really have enough information today to make any kind of judgment, but if you ask Department of Administrative Services, I think they would tell you that virtually every state agency who has asked for one of these exemptions has been granted the exemption. Now, with respect to the timelines that the Department of Revenue expressed, 6 months, 1 year, remember, that isn't in possession of the account for 6 months or 1 year. It's get one payment in 1 year. So if the Department of Revenue gets one payment in a year, the year starts over. So it's a much longer time period than is being expressed here. There was a question regarding how many collection agencies the Department of Revenue uses and how they choose those. And I'd like to elaborate on that just a little bit because I think the answer was somewhat inadequate. There are currently 12 contracts with private collection agencies which are done through an RFP process from Department of Administrative Services. They go on a list, and then state agencies choose from that list as to who they might use for a collection agency. I believe that Department of Revenue is currently using three collection agencies, one in-state and two out-of-state. The contract that's been in place for the last 4 or 5 years had, I think, 8 collection agencies, only one of which was located in Oregon. Now, through that RFP process, many of our Oregon collection agencies just chose not to bid it because they felt that the RFP was inadequate and required them to blindly bid a price for all comers from state agencies. Well, when you look at costing out the collections process and you try to decide as a private collection agency how much you're going to charge, what percentage of collections you're going to charge, you take a lot of things into account. The age of the accounts, the average balance of the account, what kind of accounts are they, sometimes credit scores. There are all kinds of methods of pricing that out. There's no way to do that. When you bid this state contract, you simply take it all at the same rate, And what we've had is we've had a lot of the pricing has become an issue in the contracts, and so out of state collection agencies have bid this stuff at a very low rate, and of course then they don't get worked the way they should. We think that's very unfortunate, and we'd like to see the state use more in-state collection agencies. As to recovery rates, it is true that private collection agencies' recovery rates have been very low. There's a variety of reasons for that. One, of course, is that they don't get the accounts very quickly, and that's not necessarily a bad thing if the upfront collection efforts are cost-effective. But in many cases, agencies are referring accounts to private collection agencies and then tying their hands. We're going to give you the accounts, and if you can persuade somebody to pay, fine, but we're not going to allow you to use small claims court, or we're not going to allow you to get a judgment and use garnishment. These are tools that need to be available to private collection agencies as well as in-house collectors. With respect, I'm going to move quickly to this so-called pilot study that was done comparing private to public collection efforts. And I did get this from Ms. Harshenko earlier, and it's unfortunately there's not much information available to go with this, but what I can tell you is that there were roughly 1,000 accounts split between three private firms and the public collectors, and the average balance of accounts is instrumental in knowing what your collection rate's going to be or how well you might do. And I would just say, if these were truly randomly selected, ask yourself how one of the private agencies' accounts, the 268 accounts, had an average balance of $1,809, and the accounts that were given to the Department of Revenue employees averaged $4,950, almost three times as much. Now, in a random selection process, I just don't believe that could happen. So in each case, the average balance of the accounts assigned to private collection agencies ranged from 36% to 51% of what was given to the employees. That's virtually impossible if this was a random selection process. So it would be good to have more information about what went on with the pilot project. It would be good to do a full cost-benefit analysis of when we should use public employees to collect these debts and when we should use private collection agencies. And we ought to explore the possibility, since it's allowed by statute, when we assign collections to private collection agencies, we have the ability to add the percentage that they charge to the debt. And I don't believe any state agencies are presently doing that. That would eliminate any outside costs. You would still have cost of administering the contracts. With that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Cindy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent National Association of Credit Management. We are a firm that's been working in Oregon, Southwest Washington, and Idaho for 110 years. Our work includes credit reports, educational courses, account management, collections, and we serve 970 corporations in Oregon, from your small mom-and-pop shops to your high-tech companies. I hate to do this, but I'm going to disagree with my friend Jim Markey on a couple issues that he just brought up. First of all, to me, this is very simple. The way collections works in Oregon, agencies who aren't able to collect dollars either send it to the Department of Revenue or send the collections to a private agency. If the Department of Revenue does not collect the money within a certain period of time, 6 months, they then also send it to a private collection agency. And whereas Mr. Markey said that he did not feel like the private collection firms were doing a lot of collections, getting a lot of success. I would say that last year, 2010, $10 million was collected by private agencies, and as you all know right now, $10 million back in the state coffers is a lot of money. You should have received from Legislative Fiscal Office at some point in time this report. And there's a summary and a larger report, both on liquidated and delinquent accounts. And I think the most important thing that I want to say about this piece is that LFO clearly says in this document, implementation of 3509, which, as Ms. Markey explained, makes it so that you have to do this assignment after so much time, he says, has brought more consistency and discipline to state collections. LFO thinks it works better this way. We are not taking, private collections agencies are not taking jobs away from state employees. They get the first shot, then it can even go to the Department of Revenue for more work, and then finally to collections. This is the last chance. This is the last effort to collect on these funds and get the money back to Oregon. My concern, NECM's concern, is that this was the process was recently put out to bid. What happens is that DAS, every 3 years, I believe it is, asks for people to submit to be on the list of those who can do collections for agencies in Oregon. That list this year is 12 agencies long, only two of which are actually located in Oregon. The third one has a branch in Southern Oregon, but all nine others are outside of our state. I would submit to you that if we're going to make sure that we do this work in-house first, do it within the agency with our state employees who are doing an excellent job in the most case collecting this money, that's great. But if we're going to go out and do public collections through agencies, which has also been effective, we need to do it with Oregon companies. This legislature has made a commitment to bringing Oregon jobs and certainly having DAS give some of this work to nine firms outside of Oregon. That should be more problematic than the may versus shall language within House Bill 3655.
Thank you. Questions for this? Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. It seems both of you have mentioned the bidding process might be problematic, but let's assume it's a better bid process. Does the industry have any industry experience rating of the average collection rates of government debt, non-tax government debt? What is normal versus the 10, 8, and 10% that we're seeing in that pilot project? Do we have a rate?
Co-chairs, Representative Brewer, ACA International has statistics on that, and I can't quote them. I will be happy to provide you with that. I would just tell you that the recovery rates in Oregon are pretty low compared to national statistics.
Yes, please.
If I might follow up, you said it's low compared to national statistics. Can you tell me why you believe that is? Is it related to the bidding process, the blind bidding process, or is it related to the internal processing before it goes out to the collection agency? What causes this to be lower?
Co-chairs, Representative Brewer, I could speak an hour on that subject.
Let's keep it to the top 3 points.
Yeah. We do a very poor job at the front end. I've been in my limited viewing of folks at counters who are supposed to take money. They do all the wrong things. Instead of saying, here's how much you owe, how will you be paying that today, they say things like, if you can't pay this today, I'll put you on a payment schedule and I can put your first payment 45 days down the road. I mean, those little things that they all add up in at the front end, and we don't do a very good job of telling people how accounts ought to be handled. And you know from your business experience that you have to have a system in place so that when this customer is 10 days late, something happens, and when, you know, and there are things in the accounting manual, but it's more accounting related and less collection related. And so I say the very first thing we have to do is revamp our front-end account receivable management system, because I don't think it's effective. But beyond that, there's coupled with that is poor information that goes out with the accounts, not updated information because people don't get that done at the front end. I mentioned in my testimony that in Oregon, if you look at the recovery rates of my members in the private sector, their recovery rates are much higher than what they are on this debt. Well, there must be a reason for that. So our guys, our people are experts at using the legal process when other methods don't work, and they do small claims actions, and they do garnishments, and they do all those kinds of things, and they front end the money on that, with their other type accounts. They're not really allowed to do that with these government accounts, and it has to go back to the agency, and it has to be approved by DOJ, and I understand that government always has more red tape, but there are ways to streamline that process to allow that process to go forward, and you would see these recovery rates jump tremendously.
Thank you. And that was 2 points, and I appreciate that. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Angela Martin, Ryan Fisher. And is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on this bill, 3655? Please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Angela Martin, testifying in support of House Bill 3655 on behalf of Economic Fairness Oregon. We're testifying in support of 3655, both because we believe it makes economic sense, but because we also believe it makes sense from a pro-consumer perspective. No doubt, debt collection ranks high on the thankless job list. Regardless of whether you're working for a state agency or a private collection firm, few people are happy to receive the phone call from the debt collector. Add to this the fact that delinquent accounts have grown as a result of stubbornly high unemployment and the turmoil brought on by the foreclosure crisis, and it's easy to understand why debt collection lands on the top 10 list of complaints with everyone from the State Attorney General to the Better Business Bureau to the Federal Trade Commission. Of the private collection firms registered to collect state accounts, all but one has outstanding consumer complaints on file with the Department of Justice. In addition, consumer complaints against these firms are registered with consumer advocacy organizations. From a consumer perspective, we support greater use of agency in-house debt collection as a way to ensure a superior degree of customer service and accountability. Delinquent accounts from the state are unique from consumer accounts in many ways. For example, the population of individuals with delinquent accounts from DHS are often more vulnerable, dealing with extreme poverty, illness, or mental health issues. Internal state collectors are in a better position to understand and make accommodations for the challenges that they face. As I was preparing for this testimony, I was reminded of an example that speaks directly to this. In 2003, when I worked as a public policy advocate for Oregon Food Bank, an issue arose with many clients contacting us with concerns over collections on overpayment of food stamps. There was confusion about the collections process and how they needed to engage with that. As a public policy advocate for the food bank, we contacted the agency and worked with them to, frankly, improve their process so that the clients understood what their responsibilities were and the collections process worked better for all parties. This is just one example of why we feel that 3655 offers the state more flexibility in managing collections in a manner that will result in a superior net gain for the state and ensure the best possible customer service. Therefore, we urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm serving as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. Last week, HISCO took a formal position endorsing this bill as part of a package of bills. And we see this as a very important step for us this session. While we were encouraged by the slightly improved revenue forecast last week, we're still very concerned about very large holes in the human service budget. And we know that those holes are not going to be fixed by taking money from other other budgets at this point. So we see this as a opportunity to create flexibility for the state to increase revenue collections and to get us going in the right direction in terms of working on this very difficult human services budget. And for that reason, we're in support of this bill this session.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3655 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 20. Mazin.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Senate Bill 20 comes to you from the Senate and Finance Revenue Committee. Passed there what it was amended, and this is a bill that comes via the State Treasurer Office from the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, MDAC, which they bring, usually MDAC brings a bill or two, sometimes more, to each legislative session, and that is concerned with the issues of municipality and local borrowing. This one seems to be trying to align some of the language and the statutes of repurchasing and refunding bonds for localities and also for some authorities or agencies, and the this bill as it stands has no revenue or expenditure impacts, and you would definitely have the representative of MDAC talk to you today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. Senate Bill 20 comes to you from the Senate, where it passed 30-0. It is a not-so-simple housekeeping bill that clarifies local government bonding statutes and removes obsolete requirements that have been identified as creating unnecessary burdens for municipal borrowers. The Municipal Debt Advisory Commission brought this to the attention of the Treasury, and we're working together on this bill. MDAC provides technical assistance to local governments when they issue bonds and coordinates bond issues to help facilitate a stable market for municipal bonds in Oregon. For a few years now, MDAC's Bond Council has been working under the provisions of a Oregon Law Commission rewrite from 2007 of the public financing statutes in ORS 287A. And since that time, we've identified the need for some of these changes. The bulk of these will clean up unintended conflicts and omissions that and just make explicit some of the intended provisions. It will clean up orphaned sections of code that were left unintendedly obsolete. It's going to provide greater certainty for bond counsel as they interpret bonding statutes. It's going to standardize local government bonding procedures and provide greater certainty to local government borrowers. I can go over the sections very, very briefly and then allow MDAC's Chair, Ms. Carol McCoug, to answer any more technical questions you may have. Sections 1 and 2 are general clarifications of local government borrowing provisions. Section 2A clarifies that local governments can rely on ORS 287A when they issue municipal bonds rather than having to refer to orphan sections of ORS that will eventually be eliminated once bonds issued under those sections have been expired. Section 3 institutes some common sense timeline changes. I'll let Ms. McCoug speak to that if you have any questions, but essentially we're conforming to timelines that ought to lay right over each other. And Section 4 clarifies that hospital facility authorities may use their bond proceeds to pay for refinancing costs, which is an intended practice but not made explicit in statute.
Thank you. Please.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol McCoog. I'm a partner with the law firm of K&L Gates, and we currently serve as bond counsel to numerous local governments as well as state agencies, and I'm currently serving as chair of the Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. As Mr. Salvaggio described, this bill is primarily a technical housekeeping and clarification bill, a number of, as he described, technical fixes that build upon two things: the theme from the last legislative session where we were in the midst of coping with the financial meltdown, and as you may recall, during that session, the legislature adopted legislation to clarify the authority for state and local governments to purchase their bonds, such as auction rate bonds and variable rate demand obligations, as a way to cope with the collapse of various bond markets. Since that point, we've looked through the legislation and recognized a couple of tweaks that we need to make to conform, as Mr. Salvaggio calls, some of the orphan legislation, orphan statutes, with that legislative policy. Additionally, in 2007, the Oregon Law Commission did pass a comprehensive omnibus public finance statutes for the state in 286A and for local governments 287A. We continue to work with those statutes, and as a bond counsel, we've noticed a couple of tweaks that need to be made, again, to clarify authorization and streamline some of the processes associated with public borrowings. And I'm happy to answer any questions with respect to the specific legislation.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Salvaggio. I walked in just very briefly, but from your testimony, ma'am, I get it that there's no intent for major policy changes. This is clarifying from previous policy changes. I remember the discussion about bond issuing and the huge omnibus work that was done here. So there is no intent to change any policy in here, simply to have statutory language conforming and clarified.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee, that's correct. And I will put on the record that it is not the intent to have any substantive changes to policy, but I should point out a possible exception with the timeline change in Section 3, which, though we don't have any objection to conforming these two timelines whatsoever, I couldn't say that I could not say with a straight face that has no effect. That will change a...
Is that sub 12 on page 5? Is that what we're talking about?
Chair Barnhart, that's correct. Yes.
Okay.
Okay, there. Thank you.
So you change it from 60 days after publication of a notice to 60 days after the adoption of an ordinance.
Sir, that's correct. That conforms with the timeline of the
property tax challenge as well.
Right.
Four challenges, exactly. Yeah. Yes, Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just so that I have a good, clear understanding, what exactly is a refund bond?
Sure, Chair Barnhart.
Excellent question.
Thank you.
Representative Bond, members of the committee. A refunding bond is a bond that is issued to refinance an outstanding bond. So oftentimes local governments will do a refinancing to lower debt service and increase debt service savings.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Is there, in connection with these refunding bonds, is there any prohibition in the statute or conversely any requirement in the statutes that municipalities, when they're letting these bonds, are required to have instruments that they can prepay without penalty?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Wand, there is no requirement for what we call redemption clauses for bonds. It's a market-driven, typically a market-driven term that is negotiated at the time the bonds are issued. Currently, on the public securities market for municipal bonds, it's very standard to have a 10-year call, for example, for 20-year maturities. That's essentially a free redemption term. Sometimes governments will want to have an earlier redemption available to them, for example, 5 years. That tends to cost them something in the market because investors don't want to have the risk of being called early. And so the governments will have to weigh the costs and the benefits of potentially having an earlier redemption term rather than a later one.
Last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So as I understand what you just said, if I can unpack it, the current market dictates that without additional cost, you can prepay 10 years into a 20-year term or any time thereafter?
Co-Chair and Representative Wong, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. I take it then that I'm going to ask a question that's a little bit facetious, but not entirely. I take it then that the Oregon Law Commission that wrote the big bond bill a couple of years ago didn't get everything exactly right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
This really deals with some issues that they dealt with as well, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. And okay. With apologies to anyone that I don't know was on the Law Commission, yes, there were certain gaps and holes in drafting omissions that we are chasing down and fixing. But
well, it was a couple hundred page bill, went through several iterations. They were under time pressure. I think we all agree that they did a pretty good job. But this is related to the technical changes, with the one exception you made about timing. This is connected to the same kinds of technical changes that they were making in the big bill that we passed a couple of years ago.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would characterize the Law Commission's review as more substantial than what we're doing here, which is trying to clarify the intent and, in some cases, make explicit practices that are, in fact, standard practices.
Yeah, they did make some huge changes in the structure of the law and in the way it was intended to be administered. That's very true. Representative Benz.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on the line 13, first page. It says a public body may authorize current refunding bonds. Why is the word current there?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. There is a distinction in law between what's called a current refunding and advance refunding. In the federal tax rules, the distinction is that if you can refund a bond, for example, the redemption date that has been provided, if you can refund that bond within 30 days, for example, you issue your new bond, you can take the proceeds of the new bond and pay off the outstanding bond within 30 days, that is considered a current refunding. If you cannot do that within 30 days or, and under the federal tax rule, 90 days, that is considered an advance refunding, and there's different federal tax treatment with respect to the proceeds of your refunding bonds that occur between a current refunding and advance refunding. So we have two sections of the statutes here that authorize current refundings and a section that authorizes advance refundings.
Thank you.
Thank you. See if I can get back to my train of thought. Other questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard today on Senate Bill 20? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 20 and open a work session on House Bill 2679.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, you recall from the public hearing, this bill is a collaboration of many months between DCBS and Oregon Surplus Line Association. And what it does is it confirms the Oregon law to the new federal law that is about to take effect in late July. And among other things, it authorizes the DCBS to enter into a compact or otherwise establish a surplus line premium tax allocation procedures among states. And you have step measure summary and fiscal statement and revenue statement. The couple of elements that I think you need to be aware of. At the bottom of staff measure summary, there is a paragraph. Currently, Oregon Surplus Lines insurance policies, except for independently procured ones without the use of Oregon licensed producers, are subject to a 2% premium tax that goes to the general fund. And a tax for the purpose of supporting the function of the Office of State Fire Marshal. The new federal law authorizes states to collect the premium taxes on independently procured surplus line policies. Under this bill, independently procured surplus lines policies will be subject to the 2% premium tax, just like the rest of surplus lines, the state marshal tax, and this, as a consequence, this bill makes the bill, this element makes this bill revenue raising.
Okay. When you say revenue raising, do you mean it now is moved into the 3/5 requirement?
That's area? Right, sir. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Questions, comments? What's the committee's pleasure?
Mr. Chair, have we amended all amendments into this bill? No?
We have the dash 2. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2679.
Representative Berger moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2679. Discussion? Objections to the dash 2? Don't see any. Dash 2 is adopted as an amendment to the bill. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2679 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 2679 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Berger?
Yes. This being a 3/5 vote, will... And as complex as it is, it is my understanding that this has been a collaborative process, and the folks who have worked very hard on this are all in favor. We haven't heard any testimony from anyone saying that this is a bad idea. So I think that there, some time will have to be taken with members of the House to explain why this is a good idea. When folks have a general understanding of these things, these kinds of bills go much better.
Yeah. Yes, that certainly is the case. Other discussion?
You don't want it on the consent calendar?
I don't think we better put this on the consent calendar. No, thank you,
probably
Representative.
Not. Probably not. All right. Is there any objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is adopted. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who should we assign to carry this bill? Do you think you and I need to do that?
Yes, you and I need
okay.
to do this.
Representative Berger, Representative Barnhart will carry. And... with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 20. Before we adjourn, I simply want to note that we are in the last week, or perhaps we may have a little bit longer than that, to pass out any bills that have to go yet through the Senate, because of the time of the session. So those who have things that they would like us to consider should be in touch with the co-chairs immediately on that. Also, I would note that we have had a number of presentations on bills that may or may not be ready for prime time, but may be the kinds of things that we'd like to consider for our interim work. We may have time late in the session to actually start acting as an interim committee while we're still here and while other committees are working furiously to finish work such as the budget. So I think I would appreciate, and I think my co-chair would appreciate anyone who has an interest in topics for those interim discussions to begin probably next month or maybe even late this month. And then continuing on into the interim, if you'd get in touch with us about those as well. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, if we have time, I would put one on the table immediately, and that was one that we took up early in the session, and it didn't look like we were going to get there, and I have promised that we would work, I would work diligently on the interim, and that is the issue around prepaid cell phones and...
Oh, yes.
So if there is a chance, I would really appreciate, because this committee hasn't really heard that bill for a while, and I'm it will be back in the February session for sure. So that is one I would put on the table as something we might want to talk about if we have time.
Well, and without prejudging the issue of House Bill 3655, if we don't actually get that one out this session, I think it's important that we consider looking at the entire issue of how the state collects debts that are due to it. If we in fact do have $100 million a year that we're not collecting, obviously some of that we're never going to collect, but if we can do better, that's money that drops all the way to the bottom line, and either in some agency or to the general fund. If that's all there is for this morning, thank you very much, and the committee's adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.